you are still on. Let me pass back the test, and then we'll start with you. Okay?
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to pass back the exam, so please listen for your name. Preeti Dongyok. There you go. Nice job. Jorge Arcia. Roy Bledsoe. I'm sorry, I don't give it out to other people. Jason, oh, I can't read your last name. Altabelli. Kevin Chu. Kevin? Okay. Megan Berry. There you go. Kasurb Chow. There you go. Nice job. Shuro D. Okay, I can't read the first name. Courtney. Andrew Bowen. Johanna Andres Chavez. Go. Ji Yoon Han. Nice job. Josh Hesterman. Nice job. Cassandra Escalar. Natalie? No, okay. Kathleen Hans. Alex Gordon. Ann Heerholtzen. Yordanos Gebertiris. Zachary Dreyfus. Samantha Hong. Let me give you these. Shin He. Vincent Malau. Rachel Lattimore. Gary Johnson. Renata Medina. Are you Gary? Okay. There you go. Nikki Metzger. Paul Maliakal. Hey, Nikki. There you go. Paul. Anshari Kumar. Mia Lopez. Emma Johns. Jenny Stuckey. Nancy O'Connor. Nice job. Rachel Sam. Oh, I'm sorry. There you go. Nice job.
My name is Kim Collier.
Okay. Okay, Rachel Sam. There you go. Okay.
Andrew.
I think we called it a while ago, and Christine has it. Christine?
Okay.
Right there. What's your name?
Medina.
There you go. Neil Shrikishan. Teresa Monkonen. Neil, there you go. Nice job. Okay, Teresa, do we have Teresa? No? Ingrid Norbergs.
I can take hers.
I don't give them to anybody else, sorry. Okay. There you go. Okay, Julia Ridgway. Anjuli Shivshankar. Okay. Nice job. Kathleen Shergi. Excellent job. Sarah Sl- Great job. Bailey Rodriguez. Charitha Reddy. Skylar Woods. Eric Vu. Peter Yang. Peter? Great job. Jonathan Verma. Nydia Trevino. Lindsay Zwiener. Nice job. Jeremy Tallis. Tallis, maybe? Can't read it. Jessica Williams. Nice job. Natalie Vasco. Oh, Natalia Vasco, sorry. Kasia Kimmel, Sarah Conlon, Myra D'Souza, great job. Jose Sanchez, Justin, I can't read it, but it looks like it starts with an H, Hudson maybe? Jasdeep Mongart. Nice job. Joe Mendez. Okay. Christina Lagos. Okay, nice job. Marissa Eubanks. Good job. Ivy Cooperberry. Marissa? Okay. Ivy? No? Pani Palanasamy? Nice job. Jacqueline Kinney? There you go. Okay, anybody still need a test? Ivy, thank you for the article.
Oh,
nice job.
Welcome.
Okay, anybody missing a test? Can you?
Yeah.
All right,
thanks.
So the average on the test was a 75. I would say if you made the average or above, you're doing fine. The grades on the homework, definitely the average is above that. In the end, I would expect that the overall scale will probably be pretty close to 90, 80, 70, the traditional scale. I would say on this exam that I would consider anything over an 85 to be A work on this exam. Anything to be over a 75 to be B work on this exam. If you're below that, I would strongly suggest that you come and talk to me about how you're studying for the test, and I can give you some suggestions about that. We have one group who is going to take advantage of the opportunity for some extra credit on the test. You guys ready? Let's see if I can get the lights on here. Can we give you the mic? You taking the mic?
Okay, we took apart the thermal printer, and so we just have the basic parts, and we're just going to show how they connect, pretty much. So we have the cord for the electrical outlet right here, and it connects directly to... This right here is actually the noise filter, and it connects through these cords right here. And then, yeah, she's sticking one together on the other side of the noise filter, and those cords go straight to the battery. And actually, the battery is really heavy, so, and then, that actually connects to the circuit, the electrical circuit, through these, I don't know what you would call them. So, yeah, she's connecting that right now. Yeah, it just sort of locks into place. And so then the electrical circuit is also connected to the, I don't know what you would call this either, but I guess the actual part of the printer that moves across and actually, you know, does the words and whatnot. And it's connected through this wire on the other side of the electrical circuit. And then you connect your, I guess, the computer onto the back side right through here. Okay, so yeah, there's an electrical circuit, and this is the connection over here, right here, that connects to the actual printer. And then the actual on and off switch was connected to another piece of this, but we couldn't take it off. And this is the on and off switch that you just turn on right there. And so that's kind of how it just works, running through the electrical outlet and going through all the processes to actually do the printing. Yeah, we had, there was some sort of like black, I don't know what it was, kind of like a tape kind of, and that like moved it across, was like strapped right there, so it would make it move across. But yeah.
Anybody have any questions about the thermal printer? Thank you. Okay, on the exams, if you think that we have made a mistake in the grading, we allow you 1 week to turn your exam back in for a regrade. So that would be 1 week from class today in order to turn it in for a regrade. What we ask you to do is we're going to post the solutions later today. And what we ask you to do when you turn it in for a regrade is you have to write down why you think your answer that was on the exam has the elements that we were looking for in the solution. So I'm not going to take any oral requests for regrades. We'll only consider them if they're turned in writing within a week. Any questions about that? Okay. So what I want to do today is I want to begin to talk about our first example of health technology, which is vaccines for preventing infectious disease. So last time we talked about the difference between science and engineering and how when we develop a new health technology, as we move along that spectrum, we're going to draw on advances both in science and in engineering. And today what we're going to do is we're going to begin to look at how we can take advantage of that to develop vaccines to prevent infectious disease. Along the way, in this first case study, the first thing that we're going to do is we're going to have to learn a little bit of science about how microorganisms produce disease and how our immune system protects us against those microorganisms. And that's what we'll spend the vast majority of today doing. We're actually going to cover a lot of immunology in one lecture, and you can devote your life to the study of the immune system, so we're really going to cover a lot of material in one day. We've put together some little kits to help you follow along in the lecture, if you could pass these out. Make sure that maybe there's one of these to roughly every four people. Okay? So that's what we'll do today. Then what we're going to do Tuesday is we're going to talk about how can we manipulate the immune system, how can we engineer vaccines to provide us with immunity against particular organisms. And then, once we understand how to do that, then we'll think about what does it really take to get a vaccine from the laboratory to your physician's office, and what are some of the problems that can come up. And in particular, we're going to think about some of the societal impact associated with vaccines. We'll look at the very positive impact they've had on health throughout the world, and what are some of the economic issues that prevent the use of vaccines that we already have available in many parts of the world. And then we're going to conclude with actually one of my very favorite parts of this class, is to take a look at some of the ethical issues that are associated with running clinical trials of vaccines, and are there or should there be differences in these ethical standards when we are testing a vaccine in a developed country as compared to a developing country where the standards for healthcare might differ very widely. So we'll spend about a lecture talking about that. What I want to do, though, is I want to back up a little bit to the first day of class. You remember on the first day of class, we talked about a new technology to treat advanced breast cancer, and that was high-dose chemotherapy followed by a bone marrow transplant. And we talked about some of the cells that are present in blood. So we said that blood is made up of fluid, plasma, and cells. And we talked about some of the types of cells. We talked about the oxygen-carrying red blood cells and the white blood cells that are important in fighting infection, and platelets that are important in helping us to form blood clots when there's been a cut. We also talked about the fact that these cells are made in the bone marrow, and they take their origin from pluripotent hematopoietic stem cells. And those stem cells can differentiate into all of the various types of blood cells. So here we have our red blood cells, our platelets, and the different types of white blood cells. And today what we're going to focus on is we're going to focus on these different types of white blood cells and how they are important in fighting infection. Here is just a photograph of some different types of white blood cells. These have been stained. The nuclei here are staining this sort of purplish color. The cytoplasm can stain either a purple or a pinkish color. And here we can see we have a special kind of white blood cell, a neutrophil. Here's another special kind of white blood cell, a lymphocyte. And here's one called a macrophage. We're going to talk about all these different types of white blood cells today. Before we get to how the immune system actually fights disease, though, we're going to step back and review how pathogens cause disease. Most infectious diseases are caused by bacteria or viruses. There are other causes. Fungi can cause disease. Parasites can cause disease. We talked about malaria, for example, which is caused by a parasite. But we're going to concentrate predominantly on how the immune system can cope with a bacterial or a viral infection. And so let's first talk about some of the differences between bacteria and viruses. Bacteria are cells that have a membrane and most of the time a cell wall. Bacteria have the ability to survive and to reproduce without a host. And we can kill bacteria or inhibit their growth with antibiotics. Viruses, in contrast, are much smaller than bacteria. They consist of a nucleic acid core that's surrounded by a protein envelope. Viruses cannot reproduce outside the host. Instead, they're going to take over the cellular machinery of the host and use host cell resources in order to reproduce. We cannot kill viruses with antibiotics, and there are many different types of viruses that can infect humans. So the first thing that I want you to do is I want you to take your pizza pan or maybe your lovely serving tray, and based on your understanding of bacteria and viruses and blood cells, I want you to identify which magnet on your kit do you think represents a bacterium, which one represents a virus, and which one represents a blood cell. So take a few minutes and do that. If you're not sitting close enough to a pizza pan, please move close enough to one so that you can see. Okay, does anybody want to bring down their pizza pan and show us their answer? Come on down. Okay, go ahead and put it on the document camera.
So here we have antibodies. Right?
Okay. You tell me.
This is a virus. You can see the nucleic acid inside.
Okay.
This we think it's a white blood cell.
Okay.
Or what? But we don't have any. We don't have.
Well, we know there's probably not. Well, I don't know. Red blood cells don't have nucleus or anything inside.
The red
inside,
blood cells don't
so.
Have nuclei. What color would we make a red blood cell? Do you think?
Probably red.
And then here we have a infected macrophage, perhaps, that's burst.
So this might be a white blood cell?
Yeah.
Okay, where's your bacteria?
Actually, I thought this was bacteria,
Why do you think that's a bacteria?
It looks bacteria-like.
How does the size compare to the virus?
Much bigger.
Much bigger.
But also, I know that these are probably antibodies that are being expressed by the immune system.
Okay. So you're getting ahead of us.
Oh, sorry.
Okay, so this is the piece of the kit that we're using to represent a virus. You had a question? They can have either RNA or DNA. They have nucleic acid core and then a protein coat. And so if you were doing this to scale, I'll show some actual pictures. If you were doing it to scale, this is way, way too big compared to the size of what we're using to represent a bacterium and what we're using to represent a white blood cell. Okay, and I'll show you some actual electron micrographs later that'll give you an idea of the scale of a virus. So bacteria also do have nucleic acid inside them. And we'll take a look in just a couple of slides. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. So they're going to have the same bases. I mean, it's the same basic. No, they're going to serve the same functions as well in order to allow the cell to make proteins and to divide and reproduce. I'm sorry? Is there a difference in... Is a bacterial or viral infection more severe? It really depends on the particular organism. You know, there are certain strains of bacteria that are resistant to many of our antibiotics, and those are particularly severe bacterial infections. Some viral infections, you know, say influenza, for example, makes you uncomfortable for a few days, but generally your immune system can fight it. We also looked at HIV and AIDS, where we have a viral infection that without treatment leads to death. Okay, so there's really just not a general answer to that. Any other questions? Okay. So in bacteria, we're also going to have DNA, and we're going to have a cell membrane and typically a cell wall. A typical scale size, here's an actual electron micrograph of bacteria, and here is a scale bar. This is 1 micron right here. To give you a feeling for scale on our blood cells, let's just back up here. These are red blood cells. Red blood cells are about 8 microns across. Okay? And so you can see that the red blood cells are smaller than the white blood cells. The white blood cells might be on the order of 15 to 20 microns across. And this particular bacterium, you get there? This particular bacterium is about a micron along this dimension. Now viruses, we'll get to viruses in just a minute. How do bacteria cause disease? Bacteria are going to invade the host. We'll talk about how they invade the host. They are capable of reproducing on their own. Once they invade the host, they can reproduce within the host. And typically the way that bacteria produce disease is they make toxins, and those toxins are going to affect the function of your normal cells. Here is an electron micrograph of viruses. This scale bar is 100 nanometers. Okay, so you can see how much smaller the virus is in comparison to the bacteria. And so on our little pizza pans, the viruses really are not shown to scale. They would be much, much smaller if we had made them to scale. But the viruses are going to consist of a nucleic acid core surrounded by this protein coat. As we saw when we talked about HIV and AIDS, the way that viruses produce disease is they're actually going to invade the host cell. And they're going to use the host cell to make new copies of the virus. And we saw when we were looking at HIV that the virus can bind to receptors on the host cell membrane, and then the virus can be endocytosed into the cell. Once it gets in, then it's going to use the host cell machinery to make more copies of itself. Those can bud off from the host cell, or the virus can cause the host cell to lyse. Okay? And so here's just a cartoon depicting the steps. Here's our virus particle to bind to receptors on the membrane of the host cell, and it forms what's called an endosome here. So there's a little piece of the cell membrane that surrounds the viral particle. The virus can act to reduce the pH inside that endosome, and then it can actually escape the endosome by causing this little piece of membrane to fall apart. And then the viral nucleic acid can use the host cell machinery to reproduce more copies of the viral nucleic acid as well as viral proteins, and those can bud off from the cell membrane. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, what was the question exactly? Again, I don't think there's a general answer to that question. It really depends on the particular virus and the particular type of host cell that is being affected. We'll talk about the ways in a minute that our immune system is going to use to recognize when a virus has invaded a host cell, so that our immune system doesn't always prevent the virus from getting in the host cell, but it tries to recognize when virus has gotten in and then mount a defense, many times which actually acts to kill the infected host cell.
Okay, so we'll get there in maybe 10 minutes. Any other questions? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't actually know the answer to that question, but most typically when the viruses are endocytosed and they're within the endosome, in order to produce disease, they actually have to escape the endosome. I'll find out the answer, but I don't know right off the top of my head. Does anybody know? I don't know. So just to review, you know, we talked about the pathophysiology of HIV and AIDS. Here's our HIV virus. And the steps that were involved, we had the docking of the viral particle on the membrane of our CD4 host cell. It was endocytosed in. And then we're going to transcribe the viral RNA into DNA by means of reverse transcriptase. And then that can be integrated into the host genome. And then the host cell actually makes new copies of the viral RNA, the viral proteins, and it can bud off from the host cell. So pretty typical way that viruses can use the host cell machinery to reproduce. So now what I'd like to turn to is, how does our immune system protect us against bacterial infection and viral infection? There really are three ways that our immune system provides this protection. The first is we have epithelial membranes that just provide a barrier that is designed to keep bacteria and viruses out. So this is a physical barrier. If something passes through that physical barrier, then there are two types of immunity that protect us. One is called the innate immune system, and all animals possess an innate immune system. The second type of immunity is our adaptive immune system, and this is something that only vertebrates possess. But basically, we're going to use these three layers of immunity to do two things. One is to keep pathogens out, and the second is to kill them if they manage to get in. And so you can think of, here's outside the body, here's our pathogen, we have our physical barriers. The next line of defense is known as innate immunity. And then for things that get by the innate immune system, we have our adaptive immune system. And we're going to talk about each of these components of the immune system today. So the first that we're going to talk about is just the physical barriers. So the physical barriers that you have to protect you against pathogens are your skin. We have about 2 square meters of skin that is designed to keep pathogens out. And then we have mucous membranes, and you actually have about 400 square meters of mucous membranes. So these are the epithelial linings of the digestive tract, of the reproductive tract, the respiratory tract. All of the linings of these organ systems are designed to help keep pathogens out. And in fact, some types of epithelia have multiple layers of cells, and others have only a single layer of cells, and it's those mucous membranes that are lined by only a single layer of cells, for example, in the gastrointestinal tract or the respiratory tract, where it's easiest for organisms to get by that line of defense. It's much harder to get past the multiple layers of cells that line the skin. So we have our physical barriers, we have our innate immune system, and the main function of the innate immune system is to produce an inflammatory response to a pathogen invasion. So if a pathogen gets past our physical barrier, then our innate immune system is going to kick in and produce what's called an inflammatory response. And in just a minute, we'll talk about what is an inflammatory immune response. If things get past our innate immune system, then the adaptive immune system will function. The adaptive immune system is designed to be able, as the name suggests, to adapt to fight off a particular kind of invader. And it's going to provide our immune system with a type of memory. And it's actually the adaptive immune system that we are going to manipulate when we design a vaccine to prevent infectious disease. So let's take a look at some of the physical barriers. This slide shows the epithelium that lines the reproductive tract. Here we're looking at the epithelium that lines the cervix. And you can see that there are multiple layers of epithelial cells here. So this whole region right here, that's the epithelium. So this is the outside of the tissue. And there are about 15 to 20 layers of cells here. The cells down here, they're active, they're dividing, they're responsible for regenerating that epithelial surface. The cells up here are basically dead cells. But those dead cells are still tightly connected together, and they provide a barrier that it's very hard for bacteria and viruses to get past. And so this layer of dead cells is very important in providing this barrier function. And you can see that in the case of, say, the lining of the gastrointestinal tract or the lining of the respiratory tract, when we only have that single layer of epithelial cells, it's a lot easier to get past that line of defense. Okay. So if you've ever gotten a splinter, you've had a pathogen get past that physical barrier. What happens when you get a splinter? So you get a splinter in your finger. What happens to your finger? Gets red, gets a little warm, and sometimes you can get pus if you have an infection that develops there. Those are all the characteristic responses called inflammation. And what happens when you see that local redness, that local swelling, and sometimes the pus? That's basically your innate immune system kicking into gear to fight off any pathogens that might be there. So if you get a splinter, then the pathogen is making it past this physical barrier. The area gets red, gets swollen, gets hot, and our innate immune system is coming into gear. So when we have a pathogen that's present on the splinter, it's going to get past the epithelium that lines your finger. Turns out that there's a special type of white blood cell that dwells in the tissue beneath that epithelium. It's called a macrophage. And the macrophage's goal in life is to patrol around and look for invading pathogens and then basically to engulf them in a process called phagocytosis. So the macrophages are going to phagocytose the pathogens that get past this first line of our physical barrier. Once the macrophages identify a pathogen, they're going to release chemicals. And those chemicals will act to do a number of things. The first thing that they will do is they will increase the blood flow to that area. And that's why the area gets red, because you've got an increased flow of blood to that area. Red blood cells, they are red. And so that area is going to turn red. It also is going to get warm. The other thing that these chemicals are going to do is they're going to cause the walls of the blood vessels to become leaky. And we'll get fluid as well as other white blood cells leaking out of those capillaries in the area where the macrophages have become activated. And so that will produce the swelling that occurs. Those macrophages are also going to recruit other phagocytes, most importantly neutrophils, to the site of the infection. And as those other white blood cells start phagocytosing material, some of them will die, and that is the pus that you will see at the site of an inflammatory reaction. So all of the symptoms that you see when you get a splinter are signs of your innate immune system kicking into gear. Here is a macrophage, here's a bacterium, and you can see this macrophage reaching out to the bacterium in an attempt to phagocytose it. And I've got a little video here of the process of phagocytosis. I'm sorry? No, neutrophils also will phagocytose things, but macrophages are sort of the first line of defense, and then once they get activated, then they're going to recruit other phagocytic cells to come in. And so here's our macrophage. The macrophages are going to cause the blood cells to become leaky, and they're going to recruit white blood cells that are traveling by in some of our blood vessels to crawl out from the blood vessel into the tissue and help mount the innate immune response. And so here we're going to see a video of blood flow, and we'll see neutrophils, maybe, we'll see neutrophils that are rolling along the edge. Yeah, okay. So this is a really cool video. So you can see the red blood cells are traveling along very, very rapidly. And you see these cells that are moving more slowly along the edge of the vessel wall? Those, many of those are neutrophils. And when there are activated macrophages out here in the tissue, they'll send a chemical signal that will cause those blood cells to have leaky walls and to recruit other cells from the immune system to come out and help mount that innate immune response. Let me just play that one more time. Here you can see the white blood cells rolling along the edge. And there are specific chemical changes that will occur in the wall of the blood vessel that will cause those white blood cells to stick to the wall and then to crawl out and help mount the immune response in the tissue. This is one that we took in our lab. Maybe if I can get it to play. Here we go. And you can see, here's a capillary. And you can see the red blood cells are going single file through the capillary. And then you can see here the white blood cells traveling more slowly along the edge of the vessel. And they're waiting for those signals from the macrophages, which are located in the tissue, to come out and help mount the innate immune response. And so this cartoon sort of shows it all together. Here's the splinter. Here's the epithelium lining the skin. So our splinter has now penetrated that physical barrier, and there's bacteria along the splinter. Here's a macrophage. The macrophage recognizes the bacteria as foreign invaders. It's going to begin to phagocytose those bacteria. It's going to cause the walls of the capillaries to become leaky. It's also going to increase blood flow, cause these blood vessels to dilate. And so here we'll get neutrophils now squeezing out from the walls of the blood vessels and coming to help phagocytose the bacteria. Okay? So this is basically how our innate immune response is going to act to help fight off an infection, pathogen which has penetrated a physical barrier. So I think we've said all the things on this slide. Our innate immune system works best for pathogens that are outside the host cell. Now, that's where bacteria are going to be located. Viruses initially are located outside the host cell, but we know that they can be endocytosed by the host cells, and the innate immune system is not very effective for viruses which are located inside the host cells. So our innate immune system has two main weapons. We talked about the professional phagocytes, so the macrophages that are going to probe around looking for these foreign invaders. One of the ways that the macrophages identify things that are foreign, things that should be attacked, is the complement system. It's a complex system of proteins. They're made in the liver. They're present in the blood and in tissue. And these are proteins that will bind to the surface of foreign invaders and help macrophages identify these pathogens as foreign pathogens. So it will help tag them as a foreign invader that needs to be destroyed. So we've got our macrophages. I think we've said everything here. We've got our complement. Okay. Any questions about the innate immune system? want to move on now to the adaptive immune system. The adaptive immune system has two main components. The first component helps us fight pathogens that are located outside cells. The second component helps us fight pathogens that are located inside cells. The antibodies are the component that are going to help us fight pathogens outside of cells, and the T cells, a special type of lymphocyte, are going to help us fight pathogens that have made their way inside the host cell. An antibody basically consists of two parts. An antibody consists of a part called the Fab region, which is going to bind on to our foreign pathogen. Foreign pathogens are sometimes called antigens, and this part of the antibody is going to bind the antigen. And you can really think of it as being like a lock and key sort of recognition mechanism. Our antigen will have a special physical shape, and our antibody will sort of fit around that physical shape to recognize it and bind to it. And then the antibody has what's called a constant region, the FC region. And this region of the antibody is very good at binding to cells of our immune system. Okay? So here's our antibody, the part of the adaptive immune system that's going to help us fight pathogens outside cells. And here is our lymphocyte that's going to help us fight pathogens inside cells. The best way to understand how antibodies help us fight pathogens is to think of an antibody as a bridge. An antibody is a bridge that links the pathogen that we want to kill and a tool that we're going to use to kill it. So we talked about the two regions of the antibodies. So what I'd like you to do now is I'd like you to take your pizza pans and identify what you think is an antibody, and then arrange the components of your kit to show how an antibody could be a bridge between the pathogen and the tool that we're going to use to kill that pathogen. So take a couple of minutes and do that. Okay, does anybody have a pan they want to show us, their answer? Don't be shy. Want to show us your answer? No? Come on down.
Alright, so this we term as a regular cell. It gets infected with some kind of either virus or bacteria. The bacteria or virus does something within the cell to produce these antigens.
Okay.
The antibodies bind to them. And then this is probably the tool to kill cell. And so it binds to the FC region of the antibody, and maybe it... Yeah, to kill it or do something with it.
Okay. So you're talking about what happens when a pathogen is inside a cell. So this was our virus. This was our bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
Are bacteria going to go inside the host cell?
No, they're going to release the toxin.
Right, so bacteria are going to stay outside. Viruses will go inside. But let's think about how an antibody can help us recognize something that's outside a cell. Because we're going to get to looking inside a cell. What happens when it's outside?
When a virus is outside?
Uh-huh, or a bacterium.
To a regular cell?
So how are we going to kill this virus before it gets in here?
Oh, well then this is probably going to have certain binding sites that the antibody is going to bind to.
And now what happens once the antibody recognizes the virus?
Well, you're probably going to have a lot of antibodies binding to it, and that's going to trigger some kind of killer T-cell maybe to engulf it and kill it.
Okay, so we're going to have this part. Oh, are we off?
Yeah, I can zoom out. Yeah, you can just see the top part.
Okay, I don't think we can zoom out anymore. Sorry about that. Here we go. Thank you. So we've got our virus. We've got the Fab region of the virus is going to bind to our antigen, which is the virus. And now we've got the Fc region, and that is going to bind to a tool that we're going to use to kill. So that's how things work when we're outside the cell. What you were saying was correct for when things get inside the cell, but we're just not quite there yet. Okay?
All right.
Cool. All right. So any questions about what happens when we're using antibodies to kill things outside the cell? Uh-huh? Antibodies can recognize both viruses and bacteria. Some have evolved mechanisms to sort of hide so that they're not a general question. Okay. But in general, the bottom line that I want you to take away from this part of the lecture is that when an antibody can recognize bacteria or virus, then the antibody is like a bridge that connects the pathogen that we want to destroy and the tool that we're going to use to destroy it. Okay? So here we've got this pathogen, in this case, is a bacteria. An antibody can bind to it, and then the constant region of that antibody can bind to a phagocytic cell of the immune system so that we can engulf it and destroy it. Okay. Now, antibodies are made by a particular type of white blood cell called a B cell. So B cells are lymphocytes that make antibodies, and they have a special kind of receptor on their surface called a B cell receptor. And you actually have over 100 million different types of B cells. And each type of B cell has a different type of B cell receptor. And there is such a diversity in these receptors that they are capable of recognizing every organic molecule. So this is just a tremendous diversity in these types of receptors, and you need it to be able to cope with the many different types of pathogens there are. So if we have 100 million different types of B cells, suppose I have a viral infection, there's going to be one type of B cell that will make an antibody that will bind to that virus. How am I going to turn that B cell on? The way that I turn that B cell on is when it binds the antigen that it recognizes, then it becomes activated and it begins to proliferate. And over the space of a week, I can make about 20,000 of those identical B cells. And those B cells are going to now start secreting the antibody that will bind to this particular antigen. So if you think about the different types of B cells, here's one type. You can see it has a different shape to its B cell receptor. Here's another type. Here's a third type. And they really do have a different physical shape to that B cell receptor that will match up with a particular antigen. So when an antigen comes along that will bind to the receptor on this particular type of B cell, then we get what's called clonal expansion. And clonal expansion just means I make a bunch of copies of this type of B cell, all of which have that same type of B cell receptor. And so these activated B cells are going to allow us to make lots of antibody to fight off the infection. In a minute, we're going to get to how these B cells actually remember that you have been infected by that pathogen. But before we get there, I want to think about how the adaptive immune system functions to kill pathogens that have managed to get inside the host cell. We saw a preview of it just a minute ago. So once it gets inside the cell, the antibodies can't get to it anymore. Okay, the antibodies are effective when the pathogens are outside the cell, but once a virus gets inside the cell, the antibodies can't recognize it. Instead, what happens is a particular type of lymphocyte called a T cell is going to recognize host cells that have been infected by a virus. And the way they do that is when a cell becomes infected with a virus, it's going to take parts of the viral protein and it's going to place those parts of the viral protein on receptors on the surface of that cell. And those receptors are called MHC receptors. And so if I've got an epithelial cell, it's been invaded by a virus, that host cell is going to take parts of the viral protein and load them on receptors that are on the surface of that cell. Now, our immune system can recognize it because we've placed a sign on the surface of the cell. That sign says, I've been invaded by a virus. And so the T cells are going to inspect the proteins that are present in these MHC receptors, and when they determine that there's viral protein that's been loaded onto those MHC receptors, then they're going to act to kill the host cell that's been infected. So now what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to take your pizza pan, and I'd like you to show what happens, first of all, when a viral antigen gets inside a host cell. How does that host cell let the immune system that it has become infected? So don't worry about how we kill it yet. Let's just worry about how we're going to let the immune system know that there's been a viral infection inside that host cell. Okay, so the two steps that are necessary are we have to have our antigen get inside the host cell, and then we're going to have pieces of viral protein that get loaded in to our MHC receptors on the surface of that cell. And so here we are before the host cell has been compromised by the antigen. Now it's been compromised, and now we've sent a signal saying there has been a viral invasion of this particular cell. Okay? So now we've got our signal in place to let the immune system know that there's virus inside this cell. So what I'd like you to do next is, how does the T cell recognize that cell? We've got our host cell, it's been compromised by the virus. It's put a signal out there. What does the T cell do? So does anybody want to show us their answer? Mm-hmm. Come on down.
Okay, so first we had the virus come into the good cell and mess things up, and then it breaks into fragments and leaves it on the MHC things, and then this T cell comes and it recognizes the fragments put out by the MHC parts, and then I guess it would replicate more of this kind of antibody for the rest of the body to use.
So we can target it for destruction. Excellent. Okay, thank you. Okay, and so you can see why this component of the immune system is a substantial advance over just the innate immune system, because the innate immune system really is just not capable of dealing with fighting a pathogen that has managed to invade the host cell. Okay, so I showed that. Now, last thing that I want to talk about is immunologic memory. So our adaptive immune system has memory associated with that. And what that means is that the first time we encounter a particular pathogen, what we're going to do is we're going to activate our B cells that make antibodies and our T cells that will recognize host cells that have been infected with the virus will build up a clone of those through that process of clonal expansion. That process takes about a week. And after the infection is over, most of those cells, which were produced through clonal expansion, are going to die off. But a particular type of those cells, called memory cells, will remain. And then, if we encounter that pathogen for a second time, it's much easier to activate those memory cells, and the response is much, much faster. And so the first time that you encounter that pathogen, you will experience symptoms of the disease during the time that it takes for your immune system to mount this response. The second time, though, the response is so much faster, you're not going to experience any symptoms. Your immune system is just going to deal with the pathogen. And so on our first exposure, we get this clonal expansion. And the clonal expansion consists of two types of cells, the memory cells and the effector cells. The effector cells are the ones that actually are responsible for killing the pathogen, but they don't live very long. The memory cells will live much longer, and then if they experience a second exposure to the antigen, they can very rapidly mount a response. And so if we look at, for example, the production of antibody in response to exposure to an antigen, here's the amount of antibody in the plasma versus time following infection. This is what that would look like the first time you were exposed to that antigen. And then because of the memory associated with the adaptive immune system, the secondary response, if you were exposed again, would be much stronger and much more rapid. And it's actually this property of the adaptive immune system that we're going to manipulate when we design a vaccine. Question? There's some debate about that. So there are some vaccines that are going to require booster shots, for example, because the longevity of the memory cells isn't long enough to provide you with that lifetime immunity. Again, I think it's dependent on the pathogen, but that's one of the reasons that we need to provide booster shots for some vaccines. Okay, so I just want to show one slide at the end to try and put it all together. And again, we really have tried to cover an enormous amount of ground in one lecture. And so what I want to do is really give you the take-home messages that we're going to need to understand the process of vaccine development. And so we said that one way that our adaptive immune system functions to kill pathogens is via antibodies. So we're going to talk a lot about antibody-mediated immunity. And the ways that antibodies work to help provide immunity is severalfold. So antibodies can recognize pathogens. So here we have a bacterium
antibodies are binding to the bacterium. Here's the Fab region of the antibody. The constant region of the antibody will then allow us to make a bridge between that bacterium and the cell, which will phagocytose it. The other thing that these can do is our antigen can bind to receptors on the surface of our B lymphocytes and activate them to make both memory cells and cells that are going to produce lots and lots of antibody. And so we're going to have antibodies that will be this bridge so that the pathogen can be phagocytosed, or we're going to have these receptors which get activated and cause our B cells to make lots and lots of antibody to help us mount a response. So these are the two major steps in antibody-mediated immunity. The second part of the adaptive immune system that we talked about is what's called cell-mediated immunity. So cell-mediated immunity is going to be important when we have a viral pathogen that has invaded our host cell. And so we saw what happened there is when our viral pathogen invades the host cell, then pieces of viral protein will be loaded into those MHC receptors, and now those can be recognized by T cells within our immune system, and those T cells can come and kill the infected host cell. So if we want to design a vaccine that will provide our immune system with this memory, you know, normally to get that memory, you have to have the disease. What a vaccine can do is it can provide your immune system with the memory without having to experience the symptoms of the disease. But depending on the type of pathogen, we may have to provide both memory in the antibody-mediated immunity and in the cell-mediated immunity. It will depend on the pathogen, and we'll talk a lot about that next time when we begin to talk about the development of vaccines. So the main things to take away today are the differences in the way bacteria and viruses produce disease, the three types of immunity that we have, our barrier immunity, which is the first line of defense, our innate immunity, that general inflammatory response, and then our adaptive immune system, where we've got both antibody-mediated immunity and cell-mediated immunity, which is very important in fighting viral infections, where we have pathogens that are located within cells. Okay. Next time, we're going to talk about two examples of viral infections and how we make vaccines. And I believe you have homework number 6 due next time. I will not be here for office hours today. I have to go give a talk at a conference, so I apologize.